We've been counting down the days in our household till Christmas. We have 9 Advent calendars this year. Even the dog has one, thanks to a very kind friend. Dog's going to be a little bit disappointed come Christmas Day when there's no more chocolates. He'll get over it. But I love the sense and expectation that abounds at Christmas. You know, wondering what you'll get, trying to figure out what to give. Looking forward to the Christmas specials on telly. Speculating about all the food. Yay, it's turkey. And yet in the midst of all the excitement, we can forget what Christmas is truly about. And so for just a few minutes this evening, we're going to think about some characters that don't always get a look in at Christmas. And now there's a good reason for that. They may be left out because they missed the first one. They weren't actually there when Jesus was actually born. They didn't get to see Jesus as a newborn baby. They pitch up sometime afterwards because they travelled a long way to get there. We're going to think of those who are often called the kings. But the truth is they weren't kings. The Bible calls them the Magi. They were most likely astrologers. They studied the stars to try and understand life. We don't know how many there were. Traditionally, we think there were 3, but we're only guessing because of the number of gifts. We don't know where they came from. All the Bible says is they came from the east, probably Babylon, but we don't know. We know they weren't born and raised in the nation of Israel. But what we do know for certain is what the Bible records for us is how the Magi responded to seeing Jesus. See, firstly, they were overjoyed at the king. They were overjoyed at the king, writes Matthew in chapter 2, verse 10, in that reading we just had read to us. Literally, they were deliriously happy. Now, why were they so happy? Well, not because they'd just been on a long journey. Probably took them a year to a year and a half after Jesus' birth to get there. And it wasn't quite as the song has it. You know, we three kings of Orient are, one in a taxi, one in a car, one on a scooter, blowing his hooter, following the yonder star. It wasn't quite like that. They were on camels. They travelled over deserts and over mountains and through raging rivers, following the star, which had arisen, signifying the birth of Jesus, the king of the Jews. And they go first to Jerusalem because that was the capital city and it was an obvious place for a king to be born. So they go to King Herod, who knows little about the king of the Jews and his birth. But he calls his scribes and the wise people and the priests who, reading the Old Testament prophecies, some of which we have heard this evening, which were written hundreds of years before Jesus' birth, declare the king of the Jews will be born in Bethlehem. And so the Magi travel to Bethlehem, and as they do, they see the star now stopping over the place where the child was. And Matthew says, they were overjoyed. They were deliriously happy. They were overjoyed at finally seeing the promised king, the Messiah. That's what Messiah means, king, Christ. Here was the one which had been promised and foretold for centuries. The one who they presumably had read about in the Old Testament scrolls left from the Jewish exile to Babylon. And these prophecies describe this king in terms like Prince of Peace, Everlasting, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. And their hope was that this king, this Messiah, he would come and he would restore our broken relationship with God. He would right the injustices and the wrongs of our world. He would bring peace to those who suffer. It's no wonder as they saw the star and the hope of such a king, they were deliriously happy. They were overjoyed. He had come. This one who had been promised had arrived. Now, there are those who get very excited at Christmas, overjoyed even, deliriously happy. They wear the gaudiest seasonal knitwear, the novelty reindeer socks, the mistletoe headband. They raise their glasses of festive refreshment and wish everyone a very happy holiday. And yet often, it's not because they're excited because Jesus has come, excited about this one who brings such promise and hope. In fact, they don't believe in Jesus at all. In fact, they want nothing to do with Jesus. Christmas, just a chance to celebrate. It's just a chance to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we might die. Now, of course, that's true, we might. A dear friend of my brother's was killed this week, age 30, car accident. I mean, they're not wrong. But if our joy is just in the now, well then, like Christmas Day, it'll soon be gone for whatever reason. We'll die, we'll get ill, our friends will die and get ill, our family will die or get ill, and soon there'll be no joy. And we can pretend to still feast and celebrate, but the truth is we know inside it's... well, it's not quite as joyful as we might make it. But if there's a king who was born, who is said to be God himself, as the prophecies foretold, who was coming, offering a bright future, a future where man and God were friends, where suffering was no more, where peace ruled and where tears were wiped away and a thing of the past. And not only does this one offer it, but you begin to get glimpses of what it would be like to have such a king who would come and do these things. And as he grows up, he begins to heal the sick and raise the dead and wipe the tear of the person saddened by grief. If such a king had come, if such a king who promised so much had arrived, would that not be something to be joyful about? Would that not be a joy that might last beyond all other things? A true joy? The Magi thought so. They were overjoyed. And then look at what happens next. We're told in the story, not only were they overjoyed, but they then worshipped the king. They worshipped the king. Now, I want you just to stop and think about that just for a few minutes. Here are these wise men who have traveled far. They're grown, mature, wise men. They're dressed in very nice silk robes with lots of bling. These guys look wealthy. And they see this child, and they lie flat before him and worship him. Just imagine if I was to go to the Princess Royal, you know, maternity wing and go before a child and just, you know, put on my best suit, put on a little bit of bling maybe, and lie flat before a child and worship him, this baby. What would the sisters do? I mean, they might think graciously, oh, nice bloke. Clearly he's auditioning to be Mr. Poppy in the next nativity. More likely, they're going to phone another ward. Now, why do these men worship a child unless he's the king? Unless they see in this child what they've been waiting and hoping for. I mean, they're not fools. These were the wise men of their day. They were renowned. And they were pagans. They weren't Jewish, so they had no historical tie to this king. They were used to being around kings. They knew a king when they saw one. They worked in the royal palaces, advising the great kings of Babylon and Persia. And yet they'd given it all up, gone on this long journey at great cost and much sacrifice to travel to worship this king who's a child, to lie down before him and give them their worship. Why? Unless these wise men, these magi, were absolutely convinced that this child possessed authority unlike any other. That this child was the one who could and would offer and bring that bright future. So they worshipped. Now, very strikingly in this passage we had read, Matthew records for us another response to the news of Jesus' birth. That of Herod. Now, Herod does not want to worship this child, as he told the Magi. No, he wants to kill this child. Why? Because Herod sees this child as a rival to his kingship. Herod might not like the child, but he recognizes that this child is a king. He doesn't dismiss this fact. He doesn't just think it's a nice bit of nonsense, or it's a made up from the scrolls that the Jews like to read. No, Herod is threatened by this child king so much so that in the most horrific, murderous act, he has all 2-year-olds, boys and under, killed. Such as Herod's fear of a rival child king. I mean, here is the ultimate Scrooge of Christmas. I mean, like Scrooge, he wants to get rid of Christmas and its cheer and its hope and its truth. He's like Scrooge who declares, remember what he says? Scrooge goes around saying, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. Herod is that Scrooge. He thinks, kill every child, kill Christmas. Now, there are not too many true Scrooges around who go around like Scrooge, wanting to stake holly through people's hearts. But there are some who display Scrooge-like tendencies. And, of course, there are some real bar humbugs. But there's not many who would say, kill Christmas. And yet the truth is, many hate the message of Christmas, would happily see it killed, the message of a king who has come to rule. I mean, often folks take the good bits. Well, it's a nice story, and it's lovely to see the kids dressed up, and I love the bit about peace and no more suffering, but they hate the part about a king who's come to rule. About a king who deserves our worship. They, like Herod, want no rival king. I mean, although they don't rule a kingdom as such, they do rule their own lives. They do things their own way. And the last thing one wants is a king who says, my way, not your way. And so they hate the idea of Jesus as king. And so reject him just like Herod. Oh, well, they give all kinds of reasons. You know, he's made up. It's just for the weak. Science has disproved him. But more often than not, the truth is, I'm not going to let him rule me. I don't want a king. I don't want to worship such a king. Maybe you see something of yourself in that. And yet, What if the wise men are right? That he wasn't a king to be rejected, but a king to be worshipped. I mean, after all, he is God, and he's come to do all he says. Surely he should be worshipped. And the wise men, in the gifts they give, reveal why he is worthy of their worship and joy. For he is a king on a mission. A king on a mission. See, their gifts, like any good present, were both generous and thoughtful. That's a good tip here for gents. As you're thinking about buying this week for your wife, your loved one, generous and thoughtful. I'm always both when I'm considering Roz's Christmas present. I'm very thoughtful. I read her list very carefully. I'm very generous with my time. I spend a lot of it on Amazon. Generous and thoughtful. Just like the gifts the wise men gave to Jesus. So each of these gifts were costly in terms of expense. They were costly treasures, generous. They were also thoughtful in that they spoke of who Jesus was and what he came to do. The gold spoke of Jesus' kingship. Gold was the gift of kings. Jesus, as we've seen, was a king, the Messiah, the king of the Jews, but not any king, as the next gift revealed. Frankincense spoke of his divinity. Frankincense is just a smelly resin taken from the sap of a tree and is used in worship because when it's burnt, it produces this incense that rises up to God in the heavens. And it's used here to symbolize Jesus' divinity, that he was God, God in the flesh, a divine king. And the myrrh spoke of what he had come to do, to die, to be our sacrifice. See, myrrh was a spice used on dead bodies when they were buried. It symbolizes death, that this king, this divine king, came to die. That was his mission. You see, he would grow up to die on a cross, to pay the punishment for our sin, our rejection of God. And in his death, he would make it possible for us to be at peace with God once more, to be friends, as it were, with him. See, here was a king who came to die for his people because he loved them. He gave up, we're told elsewhere, the riches of heaven and humbled himself to be born in a stable in a remote town in Israel. And he grew up to die in the most humiliating way on a cross, all because he loved his people and he wanted to save them and rescue them. For that is what his name, Jesus, means. Maybe you're thinking, I don't need saving. My life is fine. I have all I need. I have good friends, a loving family, a nice home, plenty of money. I'm a nice person. I do lots of good. What could I possibly need saving from? Maybe you're thinking, well, I know exactly what I need saving from. My broken marriage, unemployment, benefits, my anger, my addiction, sickness, cancer. I need saving to a better life. But the myrrh tells us something different. The myrrh says, actually, we need salvation in relation to God. We need to be saved, to be able to relate to God once more. You see, the Bible says, look, we've all turned our backs on God. We've all disobeyed the Creator. We've all usurped his rightful reign and rule as Creator over our lives. We've all behaved in this way, not just the overjoyed person who loves Christmas but ignores Jesus, or the Scrooge-like character who hates Christmas and hates Jesus. No, the Bible says, look, we've all rejected God in our own ways, and we face the consequences for that. Separation from God for eternity. And it's this we need saving from. And Jesus, knowing that, humbles himself, born in a stable, dies on a cross to pay the punishment for our rebellion that we might not have to. Then instead of separation from God, we could be united back to him. Here's a king who loved his people. It's no wonder the Magi worshipped him and gave him their treasures. And yet many think of God like Santa. He spreads cheer and goodwill. He gives only to the good and not the bad. He's distant and irrelevant for most of life, which, if the truth be known, we're thankful for, because the truth is we'd feel a little awkward if Santa or God turned up for Christmas dinner. Who knows what he might say? He knows everything. And we love the fairy tale ending. Though no matter what happens in life, it'd be all right in the end. It's all a very nice idea. And yet the reality is, the God of the Bible is far more generous and far kinder than Santa. See, the God of the Bible gives the greatest gift, not to the good or the nice, because there are none in that sense, but to the naughty, sinners, folks like you and me. See, the God of the Bible is not just an invisible benefactor far away who we wish and we hope that he might just deal with all the kind of nasties and naughties in life if he could, with a kind of cheery ho-ho. No, the God of the Bible is a God who's broken into our world, who's come and rolled up his sleeves to tackle its problems not with cheer and goodwill, but with cost and sacrifice. He is a God, a king on a mission to save and rescue. That's the God the Magi were overjoyed to see. That's the God the Magi worshipped. That's the God the Magi gave their treasures to. What about you? How will you respond to such a God? With joy? With worship? Will you give him your treasures? Will you follow him with your life?